You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Trump ran as a law and order candidate, and he's defended police departments that have been charged with bias and misconduct. Just this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions asked the court to suspend a plan to reform Baltimore's police department, a plan that had been negotiated after the death of Freddie Gray in 2015. That request was rejected yesterday, but several other agreements might be challenged as well. Joining us now for a look at the possible impact of this approach to police departments is Barry Friedman, the Jacob B. Fuchsberg Professor of Law at NYU School of Law and the Director of the Policing Project. His latest book, Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission, is from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it brings Professor Friedman to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
You say that you resolved to write about policing after 9/11. Why then?
Because after 9/11, everybody was talking about how the government needed to clamp down on our civil liberties and that we had to have more policing. And I had taught policing for many years, and I wondered what the heck they were talking about. The government already had tremendous leeway with our liberties. So I started to ask people and realized that they had no clue what liberty we'd given the police, and I decided to write about it.
And in your preface, you make it clear that this is not a book about the failures of the police, but then you blame two parties as being responsible.
Yeah, so certainly the book tells the story one after the other of how policing went off the rails and really horrible things happened to very innocent people. But the point that I make in the book is that the responsibility for that lies primarily with all of us, that we've neglected to pay attention to what the police are doing, and that we need to govern the police like we govern the rest of our government.
And the other is the courts, you say.
Yes. I think the judges have done an absolutely abysmal job of you know, we all assume that the judges are paying attention, but in truth, they're not.
You have studied and taught the laws governing policing for three decades. Would you argue that law enforcement has more power now than before?
Yes, but it's partly a function of technology as much as anything else. The basic idea of the book is that in all of government, we have front-end accountability, which is that we put rules in place and they're transparent. We all know what they are and we have a voice in forming them, but we don't do that with policing at all. We've always in this country just tried to clean up messes in policing after they happen, and that's not a very successful strategy. So we've left policing alone. Now, policing.
You're saying the rules governing policing aren't made public?
Right. That's right. I mean, most of what the police do is not public. Some agencies put their rules, their basic policies on the Internet, but most of us don't even know what the rules are, let alone having a voice in formulating them.
In your introduction, you tell the story of Charles and Etta Carter and a chance encounter with the Maryland State Patrol. What happened?
Yeah, it's truly a horrible story. This very dignified, elderly African-American couple is stopped in Maryland on their way from their daughter's house in Florida back to Philadelphia. And they're asked to sit on an embankment on a very hot July day. And the cops take apart their van. They rip open bags of detergent and cereal, throw their daughter's wedding dress out on the highway. A drug dog comes and urinates around all of their belongings. But then the extraordinary thing is that Etta Carter, who's, you know, elderly and has a bladder problem, they travel with a porta potty. And she asks two or three times to use that, and they say no and threaten to cuff her if she gets up again. And so she sits on this embankment on her 40th anniversary and soils herself in front of her husband and the cops.
Did the Carters seek redress?
They did seek redress. It's an equally painful story. They had no idea what to do when they got back to Philadelphia, and so they thought about who to contact and contacted the AAA. And the AAA sent them to the ACLU in Maryland, and they sued. And ultimately, there was a settlement, but the really extraordinary thing was that throughout the entire litigation, nobody in the Maryland State Patrol thought that anything untoward had happened.
What arguments did the defense present?
They just argued that they were just doing their job, and that's
But know. What reason did they stop this elderly couple? Was there any reason for them to think that they were carrying drugs?
So this was at a time in the country when the DEA was running something called Operation Pipeline. And the idea was to intercept, cars that would be carrying dope. Now, why they thought this elderly African-American couple was carrying dope is beyond me. But there have been huge racial effects to all of those stops.
And one of the many surprising facts you write about is the sheer number of searches conducted by police every year. 8 million searches annually of pedestrians and automobiles alone. What are the guidelines for conducting a search of a pedestrian or someone's car?
Well, under the Constitution, there's not supposed to be a search unless there's a sufficient suspicion to believe that somebody's done something wrong. But as we've learned in case after case in this country, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people are stopped without that suspicion.
And to some degree, isn't that the result of a Supreme Court decision in 1968, Terry versus Ohio?
It's partly a result of that, but that's actually not fully the story. So Terry allowed stop and frisk. But even under the Supreme Court's decision, there was a requirement for sufficient suspicion that somebody was doing something wrong to stop them and that they were armed to frisk them. But as the Floyd litigation in New York made clear, hundreds of thousands of people were stopped without that level of suspicion.
So we went from probable cause to reasonable suspicion.
To nothing. And that's, you know, therein lies the problem.
Two professors conducting a ride-along study found that there are 6 to 7 illegal searches per 100 residents every year?
That was just in one very limited place. But that isn't surprising. That number's not surprising at all.
And you suggested earlier that there is often a racial component. What about a gender component?
Yes. I think men are stopped much more often than women.
Is there a clear definition of probable cause that the police say they follow?
So, I mean, there is an accepted definition and it has a lot of leeway in it. But I think we need to just take a step back and understand what's happening in the world today because it has very little to do with probable cause or suspicion. Back in the day, that was how policing ran. There was suspicion and the cops, their job was to go after people that seemed suspicious. But we've moved into a completely different world over the last few decades now, where we've got an eye on everybody, all of us, CCTV cameras and, you know, airport security. The model now is completely different. It's that we are all being watched to make sure that we don't misbehave. And it's because the model's changed that it's so critical for all of us to be involved in the front end on what the police are doing.
You've called one of your chapters Searches Without Probable Cause, and you write about a man named Nicholas Peart.
Yeah, so Nicholas is a young African-American fellow here in New York who was stopped repeatedly by the NYPD and, you know, including on his birthday when they, you know, stopped him on the ground, guns drawn, took his wallet, looked in it, and then sort of tossed his license at him and said, you know, sarcastically, happy birthday. And that's the kind of thing, again, I just want to make clear because there are lots of cops out there doing a very important job under very difficult circumstances. All of this is a failure of us watching what the police were doing and exercising sufficient supervision on the front end.
I'm speaking with Barry Friedman, who's written a book called Unwarranted Policing Without Permission. Do you think that most Americans are aware of just how invasive some of these searches can be? You write about roadside digital anal and vaginal exams. I was wondering if those are even legal.
You have just put your finger, and there's probably a bad pun there, on the problem, which is that we don't regulate them. We regulate almost no aspect of policing, and that's what the policing project that I've begun at NYU Law School is trying to change, which is to get us into a culture where we upfront decide how we as a society want to be policed rather than leaving it to the police to figure that out.
And they're looking for contraband in the cases of those searches?
Yes.
You write about two women in their 20s who were subjected to cavity searches while children were in the back seats of their car.
Yes. A lot of crazy stuff happens in policing. And again, it's because, look, you have to understand this from the police perspective. They're mission-oriented, and we've given them a mission, fight crime, but we haven't given them any help to understand how we want it fought.
When someone is suspected of driving under the influence and cannot or refuses to urinate, is it true that police in some areas are authorized to catheterize the person?
Yeah, so the key word that you just used is authorized. So again, no, it's happening. People are being forcibly catheterized in places in this country, tied to gurneys when they resist. But there's often not even a warrant, let alone legislation that says do that.
You write that early Americans didn't like being policed. Law enforcement in the 18th century was at best a loose collection of sheriffs, constables, and night watchmen. Why did all of that change in the mid-1800s?
Well, what changed in the mid-1800s is we created police departments because everybody didn't want to stay on the night watch. And so we turned it over to the police.
And we professionalized it.
Well, we didn't professionalize it. We turned it over to the police and thought that we were professionalizing it, but that's not at all what happened. It became a world drenched in big urban machines and graft. And so then what happened is in the early 20th century, we tried to separate the police from politics And we've been suffering from that ever since.
On the other hand, have you seen the Vera Institute report that was released just today, which reviewed some state-level changes in policing policy and practice that have been enacted over the past 2 years?
No.
It found a significant uptick in clarifying and improving policies around the use of force in misconduct cases and an improvement in the tracking of police operations through the use of body-worn cameras in order to protect both the public and the police officers. So are you heartened by that?
Yes, and then there's a reason why that's happened, though the reason is disheartening. So the reason that we've had these changes around use of force policies and body camera policies is that there were big events in these countries starting in Ferguson, and everybody started to pay attention. And again, you've put your finger on a key point, which is when the public learns about what's happening, policing policy changes. And that only emphasizes that we need to be involved in the front end on policing, that policing would look very different if we were.
You write that what makes policing unique, what defines it, is a government monopoly on the use of force and surveillance to enforce the law.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, if you think about it, it's quite remarkable. We've taken a part of society and we've given them the most awesome powers that you can have to use force on us, to keep a watch on us. And you would think those would be the first people that we would be regulating very carefully, but just the opposite for the historical reasons we mentioned.
So who makes sure that those powers aren't used incorrectly? Sometimes police departments try to change things and then they run into all sorts of problems. Other cops won't talk, and then there's police unions who seem to object to any complaints about the conduct of officers.
Yeah, what we try to do, if you think about it, is fix things on the back end after they've gone wrong. We have inspectors general and court-appointed monitors and civilian review boards, and body cameras are a way to try to fix things when they go wrong, to point fingers and say someone was to blame instead of doing it up front and saying what needs to change.
We're going to take a little break. We'll come back. Let's talk about SWAT teams, because they are a fairly recent development, and there have been a lot of complaints about SWAT teams and how they have conducted their business. My guest is Barry Friedman, who is the Jacob D. Fuchsberg Professor of Law at New York University School of Law and the director of the Policing Project. His latest book is called Unwarranted: Policing Without Permission. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We're back with law professor Barry Friedman. His book, Unwarranted: Policing Without Permission, it is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And I suspect that there are listeners out there who are saying, oh, another one of those law professors who's soft on crime.
Yeah, it's absolutely not true. I tell everybody who asks. I have two young children, and I want all of us to be safe, whether it's from international terrorism or domestic crime. I think we've made a huge mistake in this country, which is to think that you're either for the police or against the police, as though some of us are for crime. I think what we need to be is sane. We need to fight crime effectively, and we need to do it in a way that minimizes harm to people.
So it's a matter of just crossing the line. What are the circumstances of the SWAT team's raid on July 29th of Trinity Tomsic and Shai Calvo's house?
Yeah, that's one of the many stories I tell in the book about policing gone off the rails. So the cops get a report that there's somebody delivering drugs, and what this drug ring is doing is dropping drugs through Federal Express on people's porches and then coming and collect them. So, and the cops know that that's going on, but they nonetheless get a warrant to search their house, and they bust in with an armed force, and they cuff his mother-in-law to the floor while she's cooking spaghetti sauce, and then shoot his two dogs, not knowing that he's the mayor of the town.
And then they ransacked the house in search of drugs?
Ransacked the house, and the only thing that they found was some money from a garden sale.
So why didn't the police clear Shai of any wrongdoing when they realized that they had received a bad tip?
Well, the better question is why they didn't get that straight before they went into the house and killed his dogs and treated them like criminals. And that kind of thing happens over and over again in the United States for the reason I keep saying, which is that we do not have sufficiently clear rules about when we're going to deploy this awesome armed force.
As a result, Shai set about not only clearing his name, but also did some research on the type of raid the SWAT team had conducted. And what did he learn?
He learned, to his surprise, that what they were doing wasn't a particular accident or unusual, but it was perfectly ordinary. We conduct tens of thousands of SWAT raids in this country every year, SWAT used to be for a shooter in a tower or a hostage, but now it's the ordinary way in many jurisdictions of delivering drug warrants.
And some of these SWAT teams even have tanks and all sorts of other things that they've been given by the military. So they go looking for somebody who's selling drugs in a tank? Armored car?
They have an argument, which is that these people often are armed and you don't want the cops to be injured either. But the problem is because we're insufficiently clear about how SWAT teams should be deployed and when and with what equipment, tragedies happen, including cops getting shot. I mean, one of the constant themes in this book is that we would all be safer and the cops would be safer if we did some front-end thinking.
Radley Bout, well, what kind of front-end thinking are you suggesting?
So, you know, the force that went into Shai Calfo's house, I mean, they, you know, when they were regular cops, they had very strict rules about their equipment and what they carried. The SWAT team, you know, kind of decided what armaments they would use themselves. And that's not universally true. There are many SWAT teams that are very highly trained and incredibly impressive. But the point is, we as a society should say, when do we want the police busting into people's homes?
And did the police ever explain why they cuffed an elderly woman and shot the dogs?
You know, their view was they got a tip about a drug situation. And I mean, I've heard this now on more than one occasion. We don't have time to investigate because then we'll lose our suspects. We just go in.
Radley Balco, a journalist, author, and leading expert on militarization of the police, has a raid map that displays all the SWAT missions that have gone bad. And I hear it's pretty heavy.
It's troubling stuff. Radley Balco is an excellent journalist, writes for The Washington Post, and is really the expert on this. And he did set up this map. And you can go look and see, you know, here's where property was destroyed. Here's where people were killed. Here's where the dog was killed. Here were the police killed.
And you list some of the SWAT missions that went bad. A Asseline Williams?
Yep.
What happened there?
You know, this is just one of these many cases where the police, again, they get a tip, they bust into somebody's house and people have a heart attack or they get shot. There's a judge in Florida who said once, you know, you went into a house and the guy ended up killed in his closet. He was holding a gun, but you could have looked. He had a gun permit. What do you think he was going to do when you busted into the house at 2 o'clock in the morning? He was going to try to defend himself, and he got shot.
We've heard a lot of stories like that.
Yeah, I mean, again—
Or we hear stories about somebody saying, I have a gun, I have a permit, and he still winds up being shot.
Yeah, well, again, I think it's because we as a society need to step back. It's what we've devoted the policing project to doing, and help the police, work with the police. Everywhere we work with the police and the communities to set out clear rules for how things are going to happen. And often those rules, when you think about them up front, make a lot more sense than what's just kind of happening.
You mentioned a number of other cases, Jerry Agee of Elyria, Ohio, Christy Cohn. Who oversees these missions?
You know, this is, again, the point, which is that they're overseen internally. And often, I mean, cops can be amazing, and they're often very well trained, and they're doing exactly what they believe we've asked them to do. We just haven't been clear about what we've asked them to do. So in the cases that you just mentioned, there are cases of cops busting into people's homes and yanking bedsheets off of people who are standing there nude and utterly humiliated, and it turns out it's the wrong house. And, you know, just like in medicine, we make sure we're blood typing people the right way. We could have better protocols to making sure that SWAT teams are going to the right address, but we don't always think about it enough.
Is it fair to assume that the police are highly organized to defend their practices and the people they are most likely to wrong are not?
So yes and no. I mean, it is certainly true that the police are organized and that policing falls on people kind of episodically. But when we work with police through the policing project, we often find that they're perfectly willing to have these conversations. Police are human. You know, if you point fingers at them all the time, they're defensive. But if you say, let's work together, they're willing to do that in a spirit of cooperation.
Would it be better if the police actually wrote out their own rules?
Well, they do have internal operating manuals and standards and whatnot.
Well, I can't believe that some of the things that you've described go by the rules that they would have written out.
Yeah. I mean, often there's big holes. But the bigger problem is that we don't have any involvement in that. So, look, I'm sure there are things you do in your job that every now and then somebody looking over your shoulder says you could do better, and you say, thank you, that's a good idea. That would be the same – that would be equally true of the police.
It happens too often in my case.
Well, but see, the same thing's true with the police, though. I mean, they when we work with the police, we find that, you know, they're glad to have these conversations, and they'll say to us things like, You know, I had a police chief say to me after we'd done a project in one jurisdiction, you know, even the ACLU had some good ideas, mm-hmm. and they did. So I think we all need to be involved in this conversation about what we want policing to look like.
Well, many people go into the police force because they want to do good. They actually want to help society. But it's all – often we hear about the culture of some police departments actually changing the way people act.
Yeah, and you've come to the root of it in some way, and I know there's all this conversation about consent decrees in the DOJ right now. But the truth of the matter is that these reforms are better for cops. They do go into the job wanting to help people, and you meet them, and they're amazing people. I mean, if I've learned anything, it's that I could not be a cop. And what they need are help to do their job effectively.
One of the big concerns that many people have is just how often police wind up using force. The use of force by police departments has been a big problem, and you found that in 2015, police killed almost 1,000 people, 10% of whom were unarmed.
Yeah, those are statistics that have been gathered nationally after the director of the FBI said he just actually had no idea how many people were being killed. We have unbelievably bad data on most of policing, which is, you know, yet another example of how we could do a much better job if we knew what was happening.
Well, I mentioned the culture of some departments. It seems that Houston police seem to be more trigger happy, with 32 people killed between 2013 and 2015, including four teenagers. What's going on with that police force?
Well, I can tell you this about Houston. There's an amazing new chief there, a guy by the name of Art Acevedo, and he's a very progressive, very open chief. And you can expect Houston's department, because they've got a chief who says, join me in the endeavor, is going to be a much, much better force.
But that's also in reaction to the fact that there have been problems in the past.
Right. We spend far too long in policing cleaning up after the mess after it's happened instead of trying to avoid it in the first place.
Did we know why cops suddenly start shooting? We just had this case of this one cop, although he's African-American, so maybe I shouldn't be surprised, who was just given a very long jail sentence for killing an infant when he shot at a car.
Yeah, you know, the criminal law is the wrong way to fix this problem. What we need are good use of force rules, and I'm interested to look at the Vera report that you mentioned. Too often we tell cops, do what's reasonable, which is not very much instruction. And if you stop and think about it, it's a scary thing to be out there on the street sometimes and not knowing if someone's armed. But the new progressive use of force rules ask cops to do the most obvious of things. Use time and distance. Stay away. Try to figure out how to defuse a situation.
My guest is Barry Friedman. He is the Jacob D. Fuchsberg Professor of Law at New York University School of Law, Director of the Policing Project. His book, Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission, is published by Farris, Straus & Giroux. And this is WMIC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the aftermath of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, but after that, didn't the Department of Justice find that the Ferguson Police Department focused on law enforcement as a revenue generator?
Yes. They were stopping lots of people and for little things and imposing fines. And then if you didn't show up in court or couldn't afford the fine, you got extra fines put on. And they were funding the city through police enforcement.
How common is that practice?
Turns out it's much more common than we thought. It's very common in that particular area of the country. And there's been some legislation now to address it. But it happens in lots of places.
And who would do the legislation? The city probably wouldn't want to do it because they're the ones who are receiving the money, helping to pay for their budget. So does this have to be done on a state level or a federal level?
Both. I mean, the state AG stepped in Missouri and has had some things to say about it. But we do need the federal government involved when there are basic human rights at stake. And that seems obvious. But, you know, again, I'll point out that's why these consent decrees often are good for police departments. They're doing things like this to work up their budgets because they're inadequately funded.
But that's all being changed now under the new administration. So do you think that we're going to see a return to some of the excesses?
Well, there's a serious concern. I mean, they're doing a review, and the hope is that when they do the review, they find out that the Justice Department has done good work. If you stop and think about it, the Justice Department can be in very few places at one time, and there are 18,000 police departments in the country. So these are some of the most difficult cases, and we need that kind of federal involvement.
And then there are the ways that forfeiture laws are being used. What are forfeiture laws?
So the idea was simple. We'll just take the money that drug dealers and others earn away from them, and then they'll lose the incentive to commit crimes.
Well, you write about a 20-year-old man who left Michigan bound for a new career in Los Angeles. He was carrying his life savings of $16,000 in cash. And what happened to him?
Yeah, you know, that what happens is they grab somebody, they take the money away, and then they put the burden on you to prove that you haven't done anything wrong and that you deserve to have your own money. And that's very hard to prove at times. And so people have their life savings, their mortgage money, whatever, taken away from them with no good cause.
And the DA actually explained that they could take his money and that, quote, they don't have to prove that the person is guilty. It's the money that's presumed to be guilty. What does that mean?
It means that the money seems like it's in a suspicious set of circumstances, and so we'll just grab the money. And I'll just want to point out to you that this is an example of why this is not a left issue or a right issue. The right's been extremely active, concerned about these forfeiture laws, and one of the strongest voices to make sure that we get forfeiture in check, because innocent people's goods and belongings and cars and homes and money are being taken away all the time.
We have a caller who has had an experience along these lines. Christopher from Staten Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, and I really enjoy your program and to your author. I've experienced a SWAT team attack. I was working on my computer at the apartment, and all of a sudden the phone rings, and it was the PD saying, please come out. And I immediately just shut down my comm station and grabbed my Hartman briefcase, stood under the garage door, and gently walked across the street reading my newspaper. And I, to my surprise, there was a SWAT team blocking off the street in my apartment. And my first instinct was to run, but no, my calmer side said, just gently go across the street and go to your club and have some lunch. And later on, about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, I located my significant other. She had locked her phone in her trunk. It was her busiest day on campus. And she says, Christopher, there's no problem. And I said, yes, there is a problem. And I was thoroughly shocked to see what would happen when someone in one state places a 911 in another state, and there is the SWAT team.
So what happened? Did they break into your apartment?
No, I locked everything up. I was a lot younger then. I scaled a 6-foot wall behind the swimming club, and then hid for a while, and then went to my lunch club at Cal State, and just chilled out.
This was in California.
Yeah.
You're one of the lucky ones because, the police did what we often wish they would, which is to say come out and give people a chance to come out. Typically right. What happens to SWAT reads is they just go in.
I've been in the intelligence business before as a contractor, and I kind of knew better. I was raised, a Christian and do the right thing. However, in this particular case, I just casually packed it up and sought another solution. And yeah, there are the examples you point out are horrific.
Thank you. I the key point of this book and the way that the book was written was for folks like you to understand that what goes wrong with policing when it goes wrong doesn't just happen to some criminal group. It happens to all of us.
So what
happened? Thank you.
Yeah, well, yes. Christopher, don't go away yet. But yeah. So, Barry, what are you saying? If we know that this is a case of mistaken identity or whatever, how do we deal with it? Some of the stories you've told doesn't seem like the people did anything wrong. They didn't resist, and yet they still were victimized.
Yeah, I mean, it happens. And, you know, to be fair, things are going to go wrong in policing. I mean, it is a dangerous business, and it involves force and surveillance. But the point is, we could do better at avoiding things going wrong if we moved things to the front end and got the public involved in setting sensible rules. And that's what we're trying to do with the policing project.
Thank you for calling us, Christopher.
Thank you, sir. Arthur, thank you for your book.
Thank you.
So what is the policing project suggesting to police departments around the country?
We're working with departments all around the country, trying out different ways of giving the community voice and just the kinds of procedures and rules that we've been discussing, whether it's setting up advisory committees or here in New York City, we asked the public what the NYPD's body camera policy should be, and we got 30,000 questionnaires and 50 organizations participated, and we'll have a new NYPD policy, I think, very shortly.
And this is not just something that happens in Ferguson. A listener says that they give traffic tickets to working people to fund government operations in places like Great Neck.
I mean, I think it's very common that we fund government through law enforcement. That's, you know, we've all gotten tickets and had that experience. I think the question is, first, do we want to be doing that? And second, do we do it in a way that isn't overly burdensome on all the rest of us? So Ferguson was completely out of control.
And you, has the situation changed? Where does Ferguson get the money these days?
Well, that's a very good question. But
they just reelected their mayor.
Yep, and they're under a federal consent decree, and they've got a team in there reforming the policing procedures.
Barry Friedman's book is Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission. It's published by Farris, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.